This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Do you wear it? You're not liked. How long till you break? You're happy because you smile, but how much can you break?
Welcome back. It's Sellers Points Episode 2. I'm totally not canceled yet. And you guys are probably wondering how that happened. But as Nick Duke pointed out in the last Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast, which you should totally go listen to on placetobenation.com, shameless plug, I am the Incredible Hulk of this lineup. And that means that from episode one, or from the last film to this one, I have been recast as Edward Norton and turned over all creative control of the film to him. Which is why all of this will be a little more aesthetically pleasing. But in the end, it ain't going to get a sequel. So we'll just reboot it again. We'll recast me with Mark Ruffalo next time, and maybe I'll be more charming. Hey, at least I'll be getting to date Scarlett Johansson in the end, right? Hey, good things happening. But anyway, here we are. We're going to talk comics and movies, TV, as we usually do on the Sellers Points podcast. And just like last episode, I have a really great guest, a guy that I have talked with on Twitter for at least a couple of years now. I think is probably the right timeline. The only guy who might be a bigger Man of Steel fan and Batman v Superman fan than me, and that if you're following me on Twitter, you already know that that is a tough bill to follow. That is difficult, but here he is, from all the way from Comicosity.com. And if you guys are not following that website on Twitter, do it. They have some of the best comics content, next to Place to Be Nation, of course, shameless plug. And this guy, I've listened to his podcast. I've been reading his work. I went back and read some of your work from before you were at Comicosity, back when you were doing your old blog back in the day, one on Stephanie Brown that we'll get into a little bit later.
back in the before time.
Oh, God, it's prehistoric. But it took that site forever to load on my computer, by the way. but it's Mr. Keith Kaulbeck from We Talk Comics Podcast. Sir, welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here. I think it's terrible that Universal has held up your half of your rights, and you're not going to get your own film.
It's
bullshit. But Mark Ruffalo, there's worse ways to go.
It's true, man. I mean, he's charming, isn't he? Just look at the guy. How can you not love him?
He's got a lot of aw shucks going for him.
Exactly, and it works. It plays so well on screen. It's kind of like, why didn't they think of this the first time? But, you know, hey, live and learn. That's the motto of the MCU. And pretty much all comic book films. I mean, you and I lived through the dark times, as we'll call them, the 90s, when it came to superhero films.
We got what we got, and we liked it. We turned up for every superhero film from Blade 3 to X-Men 3 to... I don't think I actually turned up for Catwoman, come to think of it. I turned up for most of them.
You know, I skipped that one, but I will admit I did go see Elektra.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
I sat through that one. Not my proudest moment, but you know what? I was there. I sat through the theater. I bought the soundtrack because that was my, for some odd reason, this was the music I was listening to back then. But, you know, before the show started, we were talking music a little bit. Mutual love of Our Lady Peace. Because Keith is Canadian.
I am Canadian.
But before we get too deep into all the crazy comic book stuff that we got going on, and dear God, do we have a lot. It's Rebirth week as of this recording, and it was big. And this is this is your only warning, folks. Caveat right here. If you do not want spoilers for Justice League 50, Superman 52, and Rebirth number 1, you're going to want to skip to the timestamp after the break. We'll make sure to put that in the description so that you'll know when that is, because this is not a spoiler-free zone. We're going to blow this up, but luckily for you, this is probably coming out like at least a few days after Rebirth is out, maybe a little longer. So hopefully you've had time to read it, and you can kind of get get in on our thoughts about where this is going. But just forewarned, free zone.
I'm going to go further and say, rather than if you don't want spoilers, you don't want spoilers. Even if you think you're okay with spoilers, you don't want them. This book is that crazy cool.
Agreed.
You do not want them. You want to just read this as cold as you possibly can, if that's even possible after today.
It got crazy difficult out there for that, didn't it? But Keith,
absolutely.
But Keith, let's tell the people about you, about where you, what your comic pedigree is. Like, how long you've been reading, man, and who are some of your favorite characters, and more importantly, favorite writers and artists.
I literally learned to read with comics. I have an older brother who's 7 years older than me, so he was already collecting. My first memories all have comic books around. So I've been collecting since 84. Prior to that, I read tons of just random comics, a lot from the three for a dollar clearance bags that used to be around in the 70s and 80s when comics were returnable. Crazy, heady days. So I have been a DC guy primarily from 86 to about 96 and then 2011 to present. The large gap in the middle there was going to school and trying my hand at independent film and reading mostly mature reader stuff, primarily like Vertigo and Marvel Max was the bulk of what I read for probably 15 years.
Wow. I didn't know you were an indie filmmaker.
I'm a failed indie filmmaker.
That's right.
I gave it a shot, and it's hard. It's an expensive hobby. If I had it to do all over again, I would have made comics.
Oh, dude, don't even feel bad about that. I'm a failed rock musician, so I know exactly. I know kind of how you feel there. Like, attempted to make music for a living, tried my hand at it for a year. It didn't work out, clearly. And, you know, had to go get a quote-unquote real job.
So. The only regret is to not have tried, and I gave it a good go for. I started doing short films and said if it's not anything in 5 years, then I'll move on. And in 5 years, it wasn't. So that was that. Like, I gave it my shot.
At least you made that strong deal with yourself, and you stuck to it.
Absolutely, I did. I did in the meantime get a master's degree in religious studies.
Nice.
Studying film and religion. Wrote my thesis on The Omen.
Oh.
Original Gregory Peck, The Omen. And comics-wise, currently I read a lot of DC. I also read a lot of small press, a lot of creator-owned work, mostly smaller than Image small. Companies like Comics Tribe, Chapter House, who does the Captain Canuck comics, big fan of what they do. Some that are just individual creators. Calgary's got an amazing. I'm from Calgary, Canada, and we have an amazing local scene. So I follow a lot of the creators from here. Ryan Ferrier's from here. Riley Rosmo. So just reading the local folks would keep me well into great comics.
I would say so. That's a couple of big name drops. Riley's over at DC these days. Had a pretty good run on this latest Constantine book.
Yeah, excellent work.
And I liked the art on Batman 52. I thought that was, it was unexpected because I wasn't sure how that transition from Constantine to Batman would work. Then I read the issue and I was like, wow, actually this feels, very natural. I think this would work.
Riley is not only is an amazing artist and just great dude. He loves comics more than almost anyone I've ever met. He just dives into them. And if you tell him that a comic's good, it doesn't matter genre, it doesn't matter company. Like, hey, you just throw at him, like, I think this comic is well done. He's there. He's a Wednesday warrior at the shops. He loves it. Like, it brings him such joy, and it's joyful to talk to someone like that.
And total shout out, we'll have you on the show, Riley, if you're listening to this at any point. That's an open invitation. And I know if Ben Morse from Marvel.com is listening to this, because he also writes for a Place to Be Nation, because he's a total pro wrestling nerd too. Man, I found another DC guy. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that your Marvel people just aren't getting any play, but that's another reason for you to come on the show, and we'll talk classic Marvel.
I went through a long Marvel phase. I've go through Marvel periods. Generally creative driven. I followed John Byrne to whatever he was doing for 15 years. From Superman to from Fantastic Four to Superman to West Coast Avengers and She-Hulk. So a lot of Marvel in my background. Not a whole lot currently, but I find I have the attention span and the dollars to follow one shared universe. Just happens to be DC right now.
And that's great. I mean, it's, man, today shows that it's a really good time to be a DC fan. But speaking of those kind of classic creators like Byrne, because Byrne is a guy that definitely defined Superman for me for a long time. I've been collecting all of those Man of Steel reprints in trade. They've only got one more to go. I'm so looking forward to that. But on a kind of a sad note, well, a very sad note, actually, from this past week, we lost one of the all-time greats. A guy who, honestly, like his portfolio was probably not as full as some other classic comics creators, because, I mean, the guy was still very young, only like 53 years old. But we lost Darwin Cook. And, I mean, that... He was one of my top creators at DC, or top creators anywhere. And to have lost him at such a young age after, like, you know, a very, like, ugly battle with cancer, I mean, it hits hard. It hit the whole fandom hard. And, you know, we're still feeling it today, but, I mean, what a legacy that guy leaves behind. You know, he's... from his time on Catwoman with Ed Brubaker to The New Frontier, of course. I mean, you can't deny that. And then some of his more recent work with Twilight Children over at Vertigo. Just phenomenal work end to end. I mean, Keith, you were a fan of his too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, particularly New Frontier and his Before Watchmen work as well. I mean, it was interesting because Darwin Cook was kind of the poster child for optimistic Silver Age comics, with New Frontier, and then to pair him with Watchmen, arguably the most cynical comic ever made, was such an interesting direction to go. And so much credit to him for having taken that. He was an outspoken opponent of where superhero comics were at in present day, and to step in and everyone took such a hit that was a creator on Before Watchmen because it was a controversial piece, and for him to go in with both feet and make really positive, upbeat stories, superhero stories, out of those characters. And to make you care about these characters that were not necessarily as developed in the original work, it was bold and it was just really well done.
Oh, absolutely! His he worked with Amanda Connor on a Silk Spectre mini, mm-hmm. and that one like really surprised me because of all the books that were out there, I was thinking, she's not my favorite character from Watchmen, at all, and I was. I was like, okay, well, the creative team on this is really good, so I should at least give it a shot. And was taken aback by how just great it was. Darwin doing the writing and Amanda doing the drawing. If you haven't read that, folks, go get that. Go find Silk Spectre, the Before Watchmen Silk Spectre, and add that to your collection. It will give you a whole new appreciation for that character. If you're like me and you never had one, you will have one. You will appreciate that character after you've read it.
Yeah, I mean, she was very much an Alan Moore female character. in Watchmen. She doesn't get a lot of development in the main book. And I went back just recently and read all of Before Watchmen and Watchmen kind of as one long go. And it was interesting how much more developed that character feels with that work. Some of the Before Watchmen's, you know, they don't tell stories that needed to be told, but I think Syl Spectre was the one that did.
Absolutely. But I mean, the one for me was Minutemen. Mm-hmm. That was the Before Watchmen book. All Darwyn Cook, from the writing to the drawing, all of it. It's just him. And you were talking about like giving some characters that didn't have a lot of development, or they didn't have a lot of room for it in the original Watchmen. But in that book, I would put Minutemen right up there with the original Watchmen in terms of quality, in terms of like how it fits in with the narrative, and having as much to say as that original story. If you're going to get just one of the Before Watchmen titles, get that one.
And you can, I believe they're both in the same hardcover, because I think they're grouped by creator, so you can get your money's worth on that one.
Absolutely, that's worth every penny. That's actually a good segue into the next thing that we can kind of talk about, because, man, did you see the ending of Rebirth coming?
What could Watchmen possibly have to do with Rebirth? What could possibly segue you? No, oh my God, did I not see that coming? If I had guessed 100 things, if I guessed 200 things, I still would not have gotten there.
Not even a little. Like that was so beyond me. I was just like mouth agape, you know, when I got to that last page. Not exactly the last page of the story, but when Batman sees that little shiny object and he pulls it out of the cave, and it's the comedian's little smiley face sticker with the blood stain on it. I was like, what just happened here? Like, what is this?
Well, and I was starting to feel like they were going to go a direction of, like, you know, Grant Morrison's meta commentary, that all of the, like, you know, that the characters may become aware that they're in a comic book kind of thing, from some of the direction that the story was going. There's a hand outside, there's someone's guiding us, stuff that they have been going. And then that moment happens, and I'm like, you know, it's shaking my brain. And then the epilogue, solidifies where they're going with this. And, I was completely taken by surprise. I could not have predicted anything like that.
Not at all. And the thing is, you don't realize that that's what you're seeing, but at the end of Justice League 50, Dr. Manhattan kills Owlman, Grid, and Mobius,
mm-hmm.
and leaves the chair derelict.
Like this,
I don't know if this thing works anymore. When that moment happens, it's like, it's a really shocking moment at the end of the issue, and you still have no idea what's coming. And that's why I'm like, man, I really hope everybody who's reading this is reading Justice League 50 first. Like, finish off Darkseid War, which also dropped so much, but we'll get to that in a second. Because Rebirth itself, I mean, a lot of people have been calling it a love letter to DC Comics overall, and you know, I can definitely see it that way. I actually think this is Geoff Johns writing a love letter to his past self, saying, hey, remember how good it was to write Wally West? Remember how much fun that was? And all those cool things you got to do? Why don't we do that again? And man, did he deliver. It just kind of shows that, like, no disrespect to Mark Waid, even though we're not on speaking terms anymore.
but then who is?
Yeah. because I love his Flash run. To this day, I will defend Mark Waid's, any of Mark Waid's prior work up to like the last couple of years. But man, I think Geoff Johns may have cemented himself as the superior Wally West writer, just from how he capped things off in Rebirth. Like it's like he knew everything to say. He told us every single thing we wanted to hear, and showed us. I mean, the issue. I don't know if you picked up on this, but to me, it felt like the issue was playing out like a series of trailers for the upcoming books.
I would say yes, but not in the kind of clunky way that some of the stuff has been before.
Yes.
I mean, certainly, like, I think of the end of Age of Ultron as the worst example. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there are other books, like, you know, the DC Universe number 0 that led into 52, for example, was still a bit clunkier than this. Like, yeah. This was pretty smooth. Like, there was a couple of moments, but they felt kind of like crisis, like, you know, those moments of just a couple of panels and like, we're going to show you this little bit. It's going to make you curious to go on and find out more about them elsewhere, rather than 3 pages of preview is what this can sometimes feel like.
And they really do sometimes. Like I think that issue you were talking about that led into 52 was a bit on the clunky side. Luckily 52 turned out to be a great event. And with Rebirth, there were a couple of moments that I found myself like not necessarily caring as much about what was going on there, but I was glad that, you know, the overarching narrative, or at least the overarching narrator to all of this, is Wally West, and he's like pointing out, here's why I'm here and here's why I'm trying to connect with these people, because I feel like, you know, these are people that I knew back in life and maybe they can reconnect with me. Mm-hmm.
It gives it a very organic feel to why we're seeing these people at the times we're seeing them.
It really did. It didn't feel – nothing felt like it was shoehorned in.
Yeah.
And that is all credit to Geoff Johns. I mean, I don't mean to keep verbally filleting the guy, but that's just going to happen because he is my favorite comic book writer, and he's just cemented that with this 1-2 punch of – Justice League 50 and Rebirth. Man, I'm going to miss that guy writing a monthly book.
Oh, yeah.
But I feel like he's kind of set the table. You know, he's set it properly and invited all these different writers and artists to it and say, okay, guys, I've put this together. Now do something great with it. At least that was the impression I was left with. And I did appreciate some comments that came out of his today, where he said that he tried to address some people's negative feelings on the idea of Dr. Manhattan being in the position he is at the end of Rebirth. But he described him as an antagonist and not a villain.
Yeah.
It's like, and I can see that because I look at, you know, I like to reference the film version of Dr. Manhattan because I really love the Watchmen movie. I felt like they captured his character very well. And I could see him being that guy that when he left Earth, he said that he was done with that planet, that it had nothing for him, and he thought he'd go create some life and see how he could do with it. Could this be the results? This is him attempting to create life in a way, and it's kind of taken on a life of its own outside of him. All sorts of crazy questions here.
It's a really interesting juxtaposition of those two things, like of Watchmen itself and where DC is at currently. I came back into DC with the New 52, so I'm certainly much more positive on it than some fans who lapsed when New 52 started. But it is a darker take. Darker and more serious superheroes are my bag. So this was kind of a good spot for me. For New 52, but it is certainly a more serious take. I don't like to use the word realistic because I don't think it's realism is what they're going for. I think it's reality, you know, the idea of what would these superheroes be like in a world that had the same rules we do, as opposed to in a world that, you know, thinks it's all cool and awesome.
But everything is awesome, Keith. Remember the Lego movie? It taught us this.
Everything's great if you're part of the Justice League.
Exactly.
But it's interesting to, like, there's two things happening for me in Rebirth. One is that optimism, the hope, and specifically the legacy, the idea that these stories continue and grow. That was the big thing that the New 52 lost. Not joy, not fun. I don't like those words as descriptions for comics, but the idea that these, or films. Yeah. I mean, it's, but the idea that what I like about continuity is that it's like building a wall, and every new comic is another brick that builds this up. If it goes the wrong direction, you know, you're on the wrong side of a brick wall, but taken the right direction and you've built a house. And the New 52 lost all that continuity. It lost those threads that these stories meant something and they quote unquote counted, instead of what had been since Crisis, one unbroken thread. Showcase number 4 to Crisis was one era. They rebooted, and then Crisis to New 52. That's a long run to be building a little bit at a time. I don't think a lot of people had a sense that they were building anything in New 52.
And I'll agree with that, because there are parts of the New 52 that I can definitely say did not work maybe as well as they had hoped they would. Mm-hmm. And some stuff that even felt like, you know, good on them for trying, but you're not going to convince me that turning Teen Titans over to Scott Lobdell was ever a good idea. I mean, never mind that he's a hack.
It's an interesting meta commentary to say the DC universe plus Watchmen equals New 52, which I think is what Rebirth essentially does.
That's not a bad metaphor. I was picking up on it, especially at the climax, like whenever all of that comes together, and you kind of hear, like, you take it in context with everything that Wally was saying leading up to that, mm-hmm. how it felt like, you know, in terms of time, like 10 years of memories were stolen from that world. Mm-hmm. But then he kind of backtracks a little bit and says, no, it's not about the time. Like, love was stolen from us. And now we're kind of taking it back. And whenever you think about that in terms of when Watchmen came out and the after effect of it, Len Wein, the editor of Watchmen, actually said it himself back in 2009 that after Watchmen came out, it seemed like everything in comics went dark and gritty. Everybody went that direction.
I think, I mean, there was a lot of things happening at the same time. And I think, I mean, Watchmen is after a couple of other things that had already started that train. Certainly what Frank Miller was doing. Camelot 3000 had changed the rules for what you could do in comics.
And Miracle Man, Alan Moore work from Marvel. It wasn't Marvel at the time, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was I've blanked. Eclipse. Eclipse did some of them. It was published by two or three different over the course of the run.
But yeah, and Dark Knight Returns was around actually the same year as Watchmen. So it's like
Camelot 3000 is kind of the missing link there. It's the forgotten piece of this, it came before, and Camelot 3000 was the first DC book that was mature readers and sold only through comic shops. And Swamp Thing was around that same time, Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, that they then switched over to mature readers and only did it through shops. And it changed the rules. Comics for more than 10 years had been primarily aimed at college and up. Mm-hmm. And the advent of the comic shop and the direct market meant that you could then create work that would never be on a newsstand. And once it was no longer on a newsstand, you could tailor work to actually being college and up. as opposed to it's got to reach all audiences, but the story is more aimed, this stuff could be solely aimed. And then once that opened up, you have works like Watchmen and Dark Knight that are the deconstruction, because they're meant for people who grow up on superheroes, and now they're, you know, bright enough that they can handle a complex deconstruction of all of those things, all of those concepts.
And that's what I really love about where it seems we're heading with Rebirth is we've spent all that time, all those years, like deconstructing the superhero, and it seems like, you know, Watchmen wasn't the beginning and end of the deconstruction of superheroes. It seems like that's been just ongoing since.
Mm-hmm.
Like we've
continuously
done it, and it's been done to death. So now that we've completely deconstructed superheroes, maybe we can try putting them back together and reminding us all, or reminding the larger public, why we love these characters in the first place. Mm-hmm. And you know, for its time, like I take nothing away from Watchmen or Dark Knight Returns for what they did and what they are. I own both. I love both books for the things that they did, and it certainly made creators think about things in a different way, and certainly shook things up.
Mm-hmm.
But there comes a time, and I think that time is now, that we need to get back to that idea of, you know, I don't want to call it simpler times, because you can't go home again. I mean, you can't go back to like putting the genie back in the bottle, but you can still like bring that hope and that optimism back and show that in spite of all the, like, I guess the darkness that kind of surrounds or like surrounds these characters sometimes, I'd like to thank Will Arnett for having that song stuck in my head now.
I think that Johns is quite good at this. There's not a lot of reconstruction that happens in superheroes. There's deconstruction, and then it's almost deconstruction, because there's this group of creators that is so fixated on the Silver Age and the early Bronze Age that they're trying to recapture that by just resetting. And I think Busick's in that pile. I think that Mark Waid is in that pile. Mm-hmm. They do what they do, but I think that it's often backward looking. It is about restoring what was. Johns is really good at saying, these are the bits from that are good, but we have to go forward. I think John Byrne was always good at that. John Rick's a lot of flack these days, but he was always good at, here are the pieces that work and let's go.
He certainly did that with Superman.
Superman and Fantastic Four as well.
Oh, yeah.
He rebuilt that team. Like, he rebuilt that book, and people have continued to copy him, and anyone who hasn't copied him failed.
And that's fair enough. I mean, despite the fact that he kind of became a bit of an asshole.
He did. Yeah, I don't think he became it. I think he was all the time, but we didn't have the internet.
That's true too. And it's funny and a bit ironic that Mark Waid was one of the biggest John Byrne detractors in the world, and now he has become him.
Pretty much.
So there you go, Mark. You will never be on this show. Not because I wouldn't have you, because I would love to have my fellow Alabamian on the show. It's just that after all this, there's no way he's ever going to talk to me. You see me at a show, he might punch me in the head, which, you know, I can't say I don't deserve. Go ahead, Mark. I got that one coming. But, you know, I'm always game to talk to Mark Waid, because I think if I got him on a Superman Birthright tangent, that it might actually be incredibly entertaining. because I still love that book. And I know that I'm probably in a minority of Superman fans there, but that's okay.
I think it wouldn't be a minority of Superman fans, but it's definitely a divisive book.
It is that. And I had no idea that it was so until very recently, when I was talking to somebody who just adamantly hates it. And I was kind of shocked, because everybody I've ever talked to about the book just loved it the same way I did. And then I hear this person like, oh, everybody hated that book when it came out. I was like, really?
I think I mean, I know what my reaction was to the book. I don't care for it.
Okay.
But my issue with the book when it came out was it felt so specifically set against John Byrne's era. It was so focused on resetting what Byrne had built, was what I felt at the time. And then now that I've read interviews with Mark Waid, it's 100% confirmed that that was his intention. So I don't think I was in the wrong to have made that assumption.
Oh, no, I can totally see it.
Yeah, he was very much trying to pull apart what Byrne had built. And for me, if it's Mark Waid against John Byrne, then, you know, fight it out. But that means you're pulling apart the work that Jerry Ordway did, that Dan Jurgens did, that Roger Stern did, and then you're getting into some sacred cows for me.
I want to sell tickets to that fight because I would clean up. And I'm wondering what the Vegas over-under on that would be because, man, seeing Mark Waid and John Byrne just got come to fisticuffs, please let that happen.
I would pay good money.
Oh, that's Superman and Ali all over again.
Even with the lousy exchange rate, I would pay cash American for that.
Oh, it would be worth it. I'd have to go see that in person. I don't care where it is. I'd be like, I will spend all my life savings to see this fight. Let that happen. But that's it's funny that you mentioned about, you know, superheroes being viewed as gods and how, like, after they were deconstructed, a lot of writers and artists started, like, taking them in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a line in Justice League 50 said by Superman he says specifically, "We're not gods.
We were never gods."
I said, "We were never gods." Yeah. And I thought that was, now that you say it like that and kind of put it that way and in context with Rebirth, I'm like, that wasn't Superman saying that. That was Geoff Johns.
And that's, and that to me, like, New 52, as well as being, you know, Dan DiDio and Jim Lee's baby, was so much Grant Morrison's influence on DC.
Oh, very much so.
And that is, like, that is Morrison's view of these characters, that they are gods among us. So it is interesting to have them, you know, do a two-page splash, and that's all that you're getting. Like, that's the point of that two-page splash is, we were never gods.
And you know what? No disrespect to the Grant Morrison fans out there, because I know how rabid you folks are. And I don't want my Twitter feed blowing up with you, but I'm glad he gone. That's all I'm going to say.
I absolutely adore Grant Morrison when he's doing his own thing.
There you go.
I've said since he did Animal Man, you know, 25 years ago, I have always said Grant Morrison doesn't play well with others.
He really doesn't.
And I don't believe he makes work that is meant to have other people play with the toys afterward. And I think that his take on Superman was that as a graphic novel, that as an out of continuity work would have been incredible to me. As something that was supposed to be building this character for the future, absolutely did not work.
And, you know, speaking as a longtime Superman fan, and even as a fan of that Action Comics run, when they revealed that both the Kents were already dead, my heart died a little bit that day, because I'm a big fan of the era of Superman when the Kents are alive. I love it when he can go and talk to Ma and Pa Kent and have those conversations as an adult. Like, they can see him having grown into being Superman, and they can commentate. They can kind of, I guess it provides a grounding for Superman. You know, like, you know, he's gotten in touch with his Kryptonian side, with his alien side. But if the Kents are alive and he's going back to visit Ma and Pa, like, on the weekends or, like, at the holidays, he can never, ever forget that he's still Clark Kent from Smallville, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a fundamental difference of opinion on that character. Is Clark Kent the real person, or is Kal-El the real person? Does Kal-El pretend to be Clark Kent, or is Clark Kent him all the time? And it's a fundamental difference of opinion. And I grew up in the post-crisis era where very much he was Clark Kent. You know, in that origin, he didn't even have his powers until he was a teenager. So he lived as a human for, you know, into his teens, which is, you know, very much not the Silver Age take where everyone calls him Cal.
And that's
because he's Superman first.
And that's my Superman too. Or like, I think of him as Clark. Like, and the thing is, mm-hmm. like, he and Batman to me have so many like similarities. And everybody thinks of them as a dichotomy between like two personalities.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, they're both three. Like, Superman is the public persona, like the hero, the superhero that everybody sees.
Yeah.
The one that fights supervillains, and that's who they know. There's the Clark Kent persona that he puts up when he's around other people, and he's trying to hide that he's Superman from people that don't know anything about him other than what he's presenting there. And then there's the third persona where he's fully relaxed. He is himself. He's not the posturing superhero. He's not the guy trying to hide behind a pair of glasses. He is himself. And that's the guy he is when he's around his parents, he's around the Kents, or in certain iterations when he's around Lois or Lana, anybody that knows who he is. And they don't see him as Superman. They don't see him as Clark, the disguise. They see him as Clark Kent, the guy that has always been a part of my life. And that's who he really is, because that's him unfiltered.
Yeah.
Bruce is the same way. You got Bruce Playboy, Batman, the Dark Avenger, who's trying to frighten everybody. And then there's the Bruce that has conversations with Alfred and gets put in his place.
Yeah, and it's really just Alfred and Damian are the only ones, and the inner circle are the only ones that see that Bruce.
Oh, Dick Grayson even most sees of that Bruce.
Yeah, even the extended family doesn't usually see that Bruce Wayne, though.
I think it's you can always tell which ones have seen the real Bruce, because they're the ones that aren't afraid to talk to him a certain way. Like, Alfred does not have a filter around Bruce Wayne, nor does Damian, and Dick Grayson never did. Selena doesn't either. I love that about her. I love that when they get together, like, Hush is still my favorite all-time favorite Batman story. And the way she talks to Bruce in that story is, like, that's perfect. Like, she does not take his shit. It's like you're not going to talk to me like I'm one of your, like, little lackeys or, like, children. It's like, I'm not a soldier. I am my own person. I can leave this cave anytime I want. And I love that. I love that that kind of dichotomy, because that's how I see these heroes. Like, they're a grouping of three personalities. And that's where I hope we're headed back to with Rebirth. And I got a list of books that I know that I'm trying out. But I'm interested to hear what has already made your pull list for Rebirth. Like, what are you already, like, just itching to download and get on right now? Like, if you had to pick, like, three Rebirth books that you would say are the top books that everybody needs to check out, which ones are you picking?
Action Comics, I've hit the subscribe button on Comixology. I did, like, the day that it was first posted. That's easily the one I'm most looking forward to. Lois and Clark is my favorite book the past 8 months.
Bravo.
Patrick Zercher, I really like as an artist. Interesting dude. And he's one of the artists on this. Dan Jurgens is writing Action. If I were to pick a top three Superman creators of all time, it's, you know, Jurgens, Ordway, and Byrne. So that the Jurgens is back on the main book, I think, is amazing. So that's definitely top one. Blue Beetle looks very interesting. I think it's curious to do a book about legacy when you don't know any of the characters in it. All of the rest of the books are focusing on a mentoring relationship, and Blue Beetle's setting up a mentoring relationship, but we don't know anything about this version of Ted Kord. So I think it's a neat take. After that, it's I'm kind of cool on the Bat Universe right now, so there's none of those that are really grabbing me. Supergirl, I think I'm interested in just because they've had the character on the shelf for a little bit, and with the success of the show, moderate success of the show, I think they need a new take on this character. And I think setting her up again as someone who's carrying the torch for the recently passed New 52 Superman is an interesting place to start her from.
Yeah, I'm interested in every one of those books as well. Blue Beetle was not high up for me, but I've never had a strong connection to the character. Mm. Although I really liked the New 52 Blue Beetle series while that was running. That was a Tony Bettered book. I'm not usually high on him, but
yeah.
As I read that, I got really into it. I was like, this is a really good book. It's like a DC's answer to Spider-Man, honestly. And it felt like that. It felt a lot like Ultimate Spider-Man, if I were going to compare
to
any book. And it was highly entertaining. I was just very disappointed that it didn't sell all that well. And I'm kind of worried about the new Blue Beetle having that same problem. Even though it does feature Ted Kord, and that might get some more of the older fans a little more interested, I'm a little concerned about that. And that's another thing. Are there any books that you saw in Rebirth that you looked at and thought, that seems like a book that's going to be on the chopping block in 8 issues?
I think Beetle is the riskiest one. Mm. Superwoman, I think, is also a roll of the dice. They haven't told the origin of this character yet. So we don't know how they're building that book out. And New Superman, I think, is also a risky one, particularly with so much focus on restoring the pre-Flashpoint Superman as the main Superman in the universe. I don't know if there's a need for another Superman book. It's the most DCU sounding of them. Not to turn that into an opprobrious word, give a negative connotation to refer to something as a DCU type book, but it does seem like a bit outside of where everything else is going.
It does, and it's interesting though, because if you guys picked up Superman 52 along with the rest of your Rebirth titles, and you should, because it was a pretty good issue. You kind of get a backdoor origin for Superwoman. Because you see during the death scene of Superman, these little energy beams reach out and hit Lois Lane and Lana Lang.
Oh, really? I think I totally missed that.
Yeah, you got to go back and see that.
I'll look closer. and New Superman seems to have been introduced in Super League as well.
Yep, he was introduced in there. I'm looking at the page right now. You see this energy as soon as Superman is dying. Lana and Lois both get hit by this energy thing, and then all that's left is the husk of what was once Superman.
Interesting.
I was like, okay, well that's. See, I don't know what the deal is with Lana. I had no idea that she was going to be involved. I knew she was going to be in the Superwoman book, but I didn't know that she would be carrying any part of the New 52 Superman with her. And I will say that the death probably doesn't feel as emotionally impactful as it would have if the New 52 Superman had been a hit with people. But if he had, he probably wouldn't be dying here either.
I think it didn't carry a lot of emotional weight for me. The goodbye section of it did. The death itself didn't because I knew so long ago that it was going to happen.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think they sold a lot of the feeling of it, but I also wasn't emotionally connected to that character.
I think this story, it had its moments that were very, very good, and it had other moments that felt like this whole series is just to set up the new Superman line post-Rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get the origin of the new Superman, the Chinese Superman. You get this stuff with the tie-in of the pre-New 52 Superman stuff. You also get the origin of Superwoman, or how Lois Lane is getting her power. So it's a lot of a setup, and even a little bit of setup for Supergirl's status quo
mm-hmm.
that does sound and look a lot like the TV show. So yeah. It's a lot that goes into this this one story, and you know, good on Peter Tomasi for trying to do the heavy lifting as best he could to set all that up. But I am very, very excited about his upcoming Superman book. Because it's him. He's getting the band back together, man. He's getting Patrick Gleason and Doug Monkey. That's the team. Those guys together, and with Patrick Gleason co-writing the book, sold. Sign me up right now. anything to add on that one? Like on that?
Yeah, Batman and Robin was one of the early Batman and Robin's just one of the most stellar pieces of New 52. And my biggest surprise, because honestly, I never liked that character. I never liked the idea of that character. And the father-son relationship that Tomasi wrote in those early Batman and Robins was so good. And I actually, if you go back through my writing on Comicosity, there's an op-ed where I was furious that they killed Damian. But 100% of my argument was that they were killing him to finish something Morrison had planned, not because it set the right tone for the future. And they undermined what Tomasi was doing to do that. And I don't feel any differently today than I did when I wrote that. They derailed that book, and they derailed what Tomasi had been building for the sake of closing out Batman Incorporated, which no one really cares about.
Exactly. And Tomasi was like, screw you, I'm going to go get Damian back.
Yeah. Well, and that was the thing. There was no sense to me that he was going to stay dead either.
There really wasn't.
It just seemed like, you know, that Morrison had already gone that direction, that was how he wanted to end. And they had to do it rather than it made story sense.
And it's true. Batman and Robin is one of those books that I absolutely adored in the New 52. It's one of the only books that gave me a Two-Face story too. And because that's my favorite Batman villain.
That's my favorite villain, period.
There you go. You see?
But I don't think there are any really, strangely, I don't think there are any truly great Two-Face stories. I love the aesthetic and the concept of the character, not necessarily anything he's been in.
I hope that we're getting one, an all-star Batman with Scott Snyder handling the character. I'm very excited about that book. That book is a license for DC to print money. That book's going to sell. There's no doubt in my mind that's a hit. I'm buying it. You sold me on it when you said Scott Snyder, Two-Face. Done.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's pull
list. Road trip with Two-Face.
I'm in. I'm so in, and I'm never leaving. I will ride that train all the way to the bitter end. I don't care how bad it gets. Yeah, I do. If it's truly terrible, I'll call it out for what it is, and I'll drop the book. I can't lie. But the books for me that I'm... The book I'm most concerned about being good, not lasting, because I don't think it would wind up on the chopping block or anything. But man, I really want Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps to be good. Because I got to be honest, since issue 41 of Green Lantern, it has been a long slog.
That's the DCU.
Yeah, since it came back and Hal was doing the whole renegade and carrying a gauntlet thing, it seemed like, I don't know if it was Venditti's idea or if it was a mandate from DC or somebody to say, do your take on Green Lantern, the animated series, by giving them a couple of diametrically opposed companions and a sentient spaceship to fly around in. But man, it did not work. It has really not worked at all. I don't care about any of these characters. And then these last couple of issues, the gauntlet starts to turn Hal into a construct. It's like he's losing himself to that. And I'm like, you know, this is not working. This is just no. It's running up against a lot of the goodwill, if you will. There's my Dusty Rhodes impression for all you wrestling fans listening right now. And y'all thought no wrestling references were going to happen. You were wrong. No, it runs up against some of the stuff that that Jeff Johns was doing, and even some of the stuff that Venditti himself had been doing, because he had a couple of really good story arcs with Uprising and with Godhead. I was very invested in those stories, and then we got to this after such like an emotional build up to it, and it was just boring. It felt like the whole time we've just been marking time. Like, where do I go? What do I do? And then I was thinking, okay, well, when we get to Rebirth, we're going to get a whole new Green Lantern creative team and kind of get things back to the way it was. And they announced Robert Venditti is back on Green Lantern. You can kind of imagine my trepidation.
Yeah, I think it's – I mean, I really like I've met Rob. He's a really great guy. I enjoy some of his work. I think that Green Lantern is along with a couple other books, what went wrong in the DC with DCU? I think a lot of people now have expressed the opinion that when DCU happened, it wasn't the risky books and it wasn't the different takes. It wasn't the factioning into appealing to new demographics that was wrong. Because some of those books were always going to be successful. Some of them were always going to fail. They knew that from the beginning. But they screwed up Superman, Batman, and Green Lantern.
Yeah.
And if those are the bread and butter books, and Green Lantern has been a bread and butter book for DC for over 10 years now. If those books stop working and stop selling, they're in trouble. And that's what happened. All of those books, particularly Superman and Green Lantern, felt like change for change's sake, as opposed to something that came from a creative place and telling a new type of story. Even Batman, I would say. I dropped all the Batman books within a month of the beginning of DCU because I actually like Commissioner Gordon, and whoever that 30-year-old dude with the six-pack was that was in Batman, I never saw him before.
So I was a big fan of Super Heavy, but that's because it introduced a villain that I thought was very compelling, and it took a new approach to Gordon that had never been tried before. But there were I knew a lot of people who had that same feeling. They weren't digging what was going on there. It didn't, especially after the epic that was Endgame. It didn't feel like this was the direction that a lot of people wanted to go. And I did think that it was a little strange. But it ended in a very good place.
well, and certainly switching detectives so quickly. Because Detective was the only one I was going to stay with. And then they changed creative within three issues. And abandoned the idea that it was going to be about the supporting cast. So that was kind of digressing here, but yeah, that's. I think Green Lantern suffered from the same thing of like, what are we even telling stories about? Like, is it core to this character? Like, what informs Hal Jordan that the story of him solo traveling the universe as a Firefly type character made any sense?
It was weird. It just doesn't work. But I'm excited for the future, though, because I mean they're bringing the Sinestro Corps back. It seems like we're getting kind of back to that idea of courage versus fear, and getting back into that battle, because that's really the battle that never can end. Like, it's always going to be Hal versus Sinestro, and if you can give me a good story on that, then yeah, I'm totally back in, because I like Robert Venditti on Twitter. I think that he's a really nice guy. He seems like he's always trying different things and like trying to see what works and be creative. And I think that I hope he's still got a really good Green Lantern story to tell, because that is my character. That's the one that I'm most wanting to be good. But honestly, the other Green Lantern book, Green Lanterns, has me more excited. Because Sam Humphrey's coming over to DC was a big deal. And the artwork that's been released from that, from Ethan Van Sciver and Ed Benes, looks amazing. And everything that they've, all the pitch that I've read from that, from Sam on like CBR, Newsarama, all of that sounds really great. And I am so excited to finally see, because it's been too long since Simon Baz has gotten a little bit of spotlight. And I loved him under Jeff Johns. When Johns introduced him, he was great. I was like, man, this guy is really hitting for me. I want to see more of him. And then it just kind of stopped.
It's like, those two characters both seemed to there's a few characters, more than a few, that in the New 52, it's like John's called dibs on those characters, and then nothing happened with them because he was only working on one book that wasn't even quite coming out monthly. And he was telling these ridiculously long story arcs. You know, Dark Side War was like, what, 15 issues all told?
Yeah, it's so long.
So, I mean, so you've got Simon Baz, you've got Jessica Cruz, who was like, she's going to be a big deal. We're going to get her a book any day now. And that was like 3 years ago. Metal Men are still sitting around somewhere.
And don't get the Shazam fan started.
And yeah, poor Shazam. Shazam.
That is the battle that never ends.
But yeah, like it's like he just called these characters for him. I'm going to get around to doing something with them. No one else touch them. And or anyone was intimidated to pitch them. I don't know. But then he just didn't have enough room to deal with all of the ones that he wanted to play with. So it'll be great to get those two, get Jessica and Simon some room to breathe and become part of the whole universe as opposed to part of a Jeff Johns book.
And I keep hoping that any day now Jeff Parker is going to pitch a Shazam title that's just going to like blow everybody's minds, and they're going to say, we got to publish that right now.
He must have. He must have pitched Shazam over and over. And I know that there's often books that just for whatever reason – editorial or just where the greater line is at, can't get traction. But I mean, Shazam must be one that other people have pushed.
I mean, it's just got to be because we've been waiting forever for that solo title, because that great new introduction in the New 52 from Johns and Gary Frank, I was like, man, that was awesome. This is segueing into a solo title, right?
Nope. That's 2.5 years ago that trade came out.
That sounds about right. Yeah. It's been a long time, and we're just – I don't know. I don't know if we're ever going to get that book. But you know what we're going to do right now? We've been at this for about an hour. We've been talking all sorts of Rebirth, all sorts of like just awesomeness and spoiling the hell out of it. So we really hope that you guys have read the issue by now. If you haven't, well, that's you know what you got to do. But we're going to take a quick break for that whole got to pay the bills thing. Got to get some commercials in while we're thinking about it. And when we come back, we're going to get into the movies and TV side of the podcast, because that's what everybody wants to hear about, right? And so if you haven't seen the Flash finale by now, pause, go watch it real quick and come back, because we're totally going to spoil the crap out of that one too. But it's not going to be about just that. We're going to talk some Civil War and some Batman v Superman, some of the shakeup that's been happening over at DC Films. A lot of big stuff happening there. But anyway, we'll be back right after this. Don't go anywhere. We'll see you guys in just a minute.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show, right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and placetobenation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., The Kings of Sport, led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
And welcome back to Sellers Points, the most electrifying podcast since Dwayne Johnson dropped a live toaster oven in your bathtub. We back. That's not true at all. I don't think he's ever done that. Or if he has, Dwayne, I'm sorry for disparaging you in such a way. Actually, no, I'm really not, because that seems like something you might do to someone you dislike, or you just, you know, smile and charm the pants off them like you do the rest of us. Because, hey, I sat through San Andreas too. I can't lie.
I saw San Andreas.
You see, that had some
wicked explosions.
Yes, it did. It had like, I mean, it's disaster porn all the way, but it's good disaster porn.
I have maintained for a while now that I have three ratings for movies. Mm-hmm. I liked it. I didn't like it. Explosions.
This one was explosions, wasn't it?
And man, all I wanted was giant explosions. That's all I got.
And you know what? Nothing wrong with that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with gigantic explosions occasionally, because, I mean, we go to a movies, you got a giant screen and all this surround sound. I didn't come here to see someone just emote and talk about their feelings on life. I came to see shit get blown up. I want to make use of this screen, because somebody paid good money to put it here, and I paid good money to sit in this seat, blow something up, damn it.
We were walking out of I saw Avengers 2 with my wife. We were walking out, and she said, "That movie was made by people who really hate concrete."
You know, I actually had a similar thought about certain scenes in Batman v Superman. when Superman would land sometimes, I was like, I know you know how to land softly. I've seen you do it. But when you go to talk to Bruce at the end of the movie, you like straight up like it wasn't even swan dive. It was like almost superhero landing straight down and like crack the concrete. And I was like, you know, your approach was supposed to be talking to him, like trying to talk him down and be like, dude, I need your help. Not, dude, come help me or I kill you.
It's because every movie since The Matrix has looked at The Matrix and gone, man, concrete looks so cool when you blow it up.
It is.
There's dust. It has fragments. It's exciting.
And how much fun? Concrete. How much fun was Deadpool for calling them out on that? I loved that. That whole is like, she's going to do a superhero landing, and then Spider-Man totally did one in Civil War too. I was like,
yeah, my wife leaned over and said, "Hey, superhero landing."
Everybody's going to be saying that now. Thanks, Deadpool, for ruining everything about going to the superhero.
Can't do
movies.
The 3-point landing anymore.
You really can't. Like, if every time somebody does that now, they're going to be like, "Nah, superhero landing." Running joke. Now everybody's in on it. It could have just been our thing, but no, Deadpool had to take it to the masses. What a dick. No, I'm just kidding. I love Deadpool. I own it on Blu-ray. I've watched it at least 3 times since I got it, and after twice in theaters. That was probably the biggest surprise I had, because I didn't have much confidence in Deadpool being able to carry his own movie, but I'll be damned, I was wrong. And I've never been happier to be proven wrong on that one. And that I got to see it with a great group of people made it all the better. Shouts to Jennifer Smith, my boy Greg Phillips, Andrew, David, Corinne, James, Susan. You all know who you are. You were there. But I like to shout out my friends on the show. And they're good people. Hopefully I'll get some of them back on the show at a future time. But now we're going to talk about some stuff that's been developing in the Marvel Cinematic Universe recently. A little bit of news has come out about Thor Ragnarok. Some big names joined the cast, and we've gotten a little bit more about the movie itself. Not a ton of information, because, you know, these movies are very secretive. But Mark Ruffalo has described it as like a buddy road trip movie through the cosmos, through the 10 realms, or 9 realms, I guess. They haven't discovered the 10th realm in the MCU yet, but it's only a matter of time before Neil Gaiman gets that worked into his contract. And he's like, hey, I got a movie deal, right? Yeah, sign that over. Give me some money. I'll give you Angela all day. Pay me. Pay me. And they should. They should pay Neil Gaiman for that. But it worked for Guardians of the Galaxy to have one scene on Earth and then be out in space the rest of the time, because we don't need Earth. We don't need to see it. And with a Thor movie, same with Guardians, we don't need to see it. We can be out in Asgard. We can be out in the 9 realms. You want to throw Hulk in there and make it a buddy movie? Sold. Give me that. Keith, what do you think about moving away from Earth a little bit for these MCU movies and giving us a completely different setting? How do you think that's going to work out?
Well, I think certainly the scenes on Asgard in Thor 2 were my favorite parts of Thor 2.
Oh, yeah.
And Thor 2 is one of my least favorite of the Marvel movies. So it's got a bit of a rough road coming back for me. I mean, both Thor movies are not my favorites. Thor 2 is probably my least favorite, actually, of the Marvels. But I like the idea of expanding the universe. I think that the biggest challenge the Marvel films is going to have coming up is the choice of whether they're going to recast the big roles or whether they're going to shelve characters. Mm. They're running out of time with – they can only back so many money trucks up to Robert Downey Jr.'s house before he finally says, okay, I've had enough. And some of these characters are – some of these actors are on 7 or 8 movies.
They could just CGI him like they did that young scene in Civil War. I mean,
that's right.
I mean – when he stood up, I was just like, did you guys get a time machine and go back to 86?
Did you find some leftover footage from Pretty in Pink? And
Or they've got a new formula for Botox that is just the shit.
They had good practice on Michael Douglas in Ant-Man. So
there you go. And that was impressive, too. Yeah. Ant-Man is actually my least favorite of the MCU movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of Ant-Man. It's basically Iron Man all over again. But it's the same movie. But the first part of it, though, with Hank Pym, it felt like they were setting up an espionage movie. If they had given me that,
I could have gone for more of that. Yeah,
I would have watched that like 6 times in theaters. You wouldn't have been able to drag me away. I was so intrigued by everything that was happening in that room.
Well, it's funny when we get to Civil War, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, the idea of of consequences and whose side you should pick and that kind of stuff. I did think back, like, aren't most of these movies hero is chased by bad guy, causes giant destruction? Like the whole plot of Thor is every bad thing that happens on Earth is because Thor is there, not because Thor is there to prevent stuff. It's because they're literally following Thor, trying to kill him. And that's why stuff gets wrecked.
And there's something to that. I mean, there's something to that. You could kind of make that argument for the Iron Man films as well. And you could say it to a degree about Captain America, even though Captain America films presented in a much better way.
Yeah. So I think it's good to get off of Earth. I think you can wreck other planets and no one ever cares.
Sure.
I think Marvel especially in Avengers 2, but overall is very, very cautious of imaginary civilian casualties.
And does anybody believe that the casualties in Sokovia were only 200?
I caught that
in Civil War, and I was like, somebody.
Well, it slays me because everyone after Avengers 2 told me that the casualty number was zero. So I love that they backdated a death toll. So anyway, I like the idea of getting off Earth. I like smashing up other planets.
And Hulk gonna do plenty of that.
I think there's a lot of characters that they haven't played with that open up if you start introducing other worlds and other races. There's a lot of the cosmic universe of Marvel is one of the things that always really appealed to me, particularly around the Infinity Gauntlet era. Silver Surfer and Thanos and like that at that era of the in the 90s when Jim Starlin was building this stuff out. So I like the idea of going outside. I also like the idea that I'm assuming one of the Infinity Stones is going to be introduced in this film and that it's not going to be found on Earth.
Oh, that would be great. It'd be the first one since the Aether.
Yeah. So I like that idea. We also need to figure out when the Guardians of the Galaxy get rolled into the bigger picture. And you got to get off Earth if you're going to do that. I think there's a lot of upsides. I think it's interesting adding the Hulk in. I don't know where that leaves it.
Could also be because a lot of people have been saying this for a long time that they wanted to see that whole like Planet Hulk and possible like World War Hulk twofer, the Greg Pak Hulk run basically adapted into film. Which I would be fine with, like if you wanted to do that. And I was trying to think of like how could you organically set that up with what's happened in the MCU. And I don't know how you get Hulk to Thor at this point, because it didn't look like he went into space to me. It looked like he just kind of left at the end of Age of Ultron. But hey, you get him into space and he's out, traversing the cosmos with Thor. Who knows where he's going to wind up? And you didn't even need the Illuminati to get him there this time. So, hey, plus side. Let's call that a win.
There's just an offhand reference to it in Civil War. Like, you don't know where Thor or Banner are, I think, is the reference, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the only time they mention either of them. And Thunderbolt Ross makes a hell of a point there, too. He was like, there would be real consequences if he misplaced a couple of nukes. And Cap couldn't tell him where Thor or Banner were. I was like... Yeah. That's a strong point, which is why that was just one of the reasons I was totally Team Iron Man and still am. but there were a lot of breakout performances in Civil War. I know which ones really stood out for me and like the scene stealers for the movie. But for you, what was it about Civil War that really hit? Who stood out to you?
I like the ambiguity in Black Widow. I like that she wasn't sure what side she should pick, which I thought was the most honest character reaction in the film. Because I don't think they went as far with the philosophical differences they should have between Iron Man and Captain America. It was still a Marvel movie in that sense. They're not super deep films, so they asked as much of the question as they were ever willing to ask. But I thought that she was the one character that expressed that there was a philosophical difference, and that she wasn't sure which side she should be on. Because I think a lot of people. I mean, it was fun playing on Twitter, Team Cap and Team Iron Man.
Sure, it's all in good fun.
It was a goofy thing, but I think so many people went. Aesthetically, or which is their favorite character, and I think you and I both had more of the idea of. But if you think about it, like if you actually think about what these two characters are saying, is that who you want to side with? You want to side with Team Gets Away with Murder? that's your guy.
And that's where I was too. Like whenever I was picking my side, it had nothing to do with me like being a big Iron Man fan, because quite honestly, I like the Captain America movies better.
Yeah,
I love the way that Steve Rogers is actually presented as a character. Not to get into our other social commentary side of things, but I view Steve Rogers as like a version of very positive masculinity. A guy who, you know, it's just a little thing in Winter Soldier, but when he kind of makes a pass at Sharon Carter at one point, when he's going into his apartment and like she's complaining about having to go use the public washing machines, which I totally understand her plight. I've used those things before, and whoa, yeah, sucks. And Steve offers, hey, you can come and use mine. She's like, oh, what'll that cost me? And he was like, you know, a cup of coffee. But she gives him the soft no. And he totally accepts it. You know, he's like, okay, that's cool. Like he walks on, doesn't push the issue at all. And, you know, I was like, I know it's such a little thing, but I feel like there's a lot of guys who need to see that. They need to see Captain America being like a real man and being able to accept no for an answer. And that was just a moment I was like, I like that. Thank you, Cap. Thank you for being a positive role model. Not so much politically speaking in Civil War, because you were totally wrong.
I'm literally wearing a Captain America t-shirt right now.
Perfectly fine. I own one as well. Like after Winter Soldier, I was like, I'm getting a Cap shirt. I'm sold on this. Like this is, that's my guy.
And, but his point of view in Civil War is presented as, we know what's best. Mm-hmm. Like he says that. He says the best people to have this ability are us. We're the ones that should decide. Like no one's elected them. No one's chosen them. No one's appointed them.
And
they're self-appointed.
And the person who made the best counterpoint to that to me was Rhodes. When he piped up and said, that is dangerously arrogant.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was like, Rhodey for the win.
Well, and Cap has this weird approach where there's this weird moment where he says, they're talking about blaming the Avengers for what happened. And he said, they're shifting blame. In what way are you you're shifting blame to the people who are responsible for it? How's that shifting blame? He said, no, I think we should take responsibility. Like, well, we want you to take responsibility too. So what's the argument here? Your argument is that you, like, the consequence of what happened in Sokovia is you feel bad.
Yeah, that's it. That's as much as they're really willing to offer. And Tony's the only one that brings up, you know, it had to be kind of shoved in his face too, to be fair, before he would like fully back the idea of taking any kind of responsibility. But I like that he did show that. He did show that he was willing to take responsibility and say, you know, Ultron was his fault.
Yeah.
He was like, yes, that was my fault totally, which is another reason that I got on board with this idea that, you know, maybe we should be put in check. Maybe we should have to answer to somebody. And if there were actual super people like that in the world, I would not feel comfortable with them operating completely independently. That would say to me that it's only a matter of time before they're like, man, this world is really messed up. It's time for us to take it over and start putting things right. And I'm like, well, welcome to dystopia. That's how tyranny starts. And it wasn't just the U.S. government that was backing the Sokovia Accords. It was like 117 different nations. Yeah. I mean, if you had 117 nations of the United Nations actually all agreeing on something at the same time, that would be unprecedented in this world. That would be mind-blowing.
They, I don't even think you had that many agree to call it the United Nations.
I don't think so. I'm like, when they were said, when that came out, they were like, 117 nations support the Sokovia Accords. I was like, what world is this? I was like, you got what now?
I kind of kept expecting the hate monger to show up. Like someone had been manipulating all of their minds, let alone just just setting them up.
I know. My mind was blown. I was like, 117 countries. I'm like, come on, Steve. You can't ignore that. But that's 117 countries saying, huh, maybe we don't want to just have, you know, an open invitation to the Avengers to say, oh, well, the bad guy we're after is coming to your country. We better come and get him. And by the way, we're going to knock down a city in the process. But best of luck to everyone. Take cover.
Don't worry. In an incredibly awkward scene-stopping moment, Tony Stark's going to buy the building that he's about to destroy.
Oh, and don't worry, folks. His X-ray vision will conveniently tell him that there are no civilians around to possibly kill as he drops Hulk through the middle of a building, because we can all suspend our disbelief to the point that we believe no civilians were harmed in the destruction of this tower.
There might as well have been a little pop-up that said no imaginary civilians were harmed in the making of
precisely. It's like, come on.
I called those scenes the saving kittens from trees scenes in Avengers 2. They were just so terrified, absolutely terrified of getting painted with the brush that Man of Steel was, that they had these moments where they just stopped the entire plot dead so that they could save an individual. And it's not that they shouldn't save people. I'm not saying that imaginary people shouldn't be saved. Imaginary lives matter.
Hashtag that.
That's terrible. I feel bad for that immediately. I'd like to apologize to my mother and to my country.
I'm laughing. I'm almost crying.
But it is like screeching the plot to a halt so that you can make a point of no one's getting hurt, everyone's okay, they could just walk it off. And then you get to Captain America Civil War and they're like, no, hundreds of people died. Like, you'd have to be an idiot to think that.
Oh, but they, I mean, like you were saying, like minus...
even the number that they said seemed ludicrously low, but it was much higher than the zero, which is what some people actually walked away from that movie thinking the death toll what it was.
Yeah, they were like, nobody died in New York.
Right. Yeah, and then Daredevil told you it was like 3,000.
Yeah.
I think it just says hundreds die. Mm-hmm. Hundreds dead. In the newspaper headline that you see in Daredevil.
But they told me don't count that because it's too dark. It's off in the dark corner of Marvel Cinematic Universe that they're now like, Do we include that or do we just let it stay on its own?
So yeah, I was quite taken with. Black Widow, I thought had the most interesting character arc.
We've come full circle.
Yeah. I was kind of trying to bottle the ends there. I enjoyed Spider-Man more than I expected. I didn't know how they were going to include him. I thought it was actually going to be less than they did. I like that they were self-aware about the casting of... what's the actress's name who's playing?
Marissa Tomei.
I like that they were self-aware about that because...
Brilliant scene.
It was something that they got flack for right away. There aren't a lot of roles for older actresses, and to take one and give it to a 40-year-old...
A very hot 40-year-old, by the way, because
and a attractive woman. But I mean, they acknowledged that in the story, which I thought was clever.
That whole scene, just brilliant.
It is well done. It raises some weird. Like, there's been some funny memes after that, because of what actually happens in that scene, which is he blackmails a teenager into fighting in a battle in a foreign land. Yep.
We're having civil, like Captain America: The First Avenger flashbacks.
Well, and there's a funny I had an awkward moment, funny/awkward where he tells Aunt May, we're just going to go into his room and we're going to talk for a minute. And he closes the door. I'm like, this isn't okay. Like he's a teenager and you're an eccentric millionaire. It's not okay that you're in his bedroom with the door closed.
Not only closed, but locked. Like he shuts the door and like clicks the lock over. I was like,
that's not cool.
I was like, this is getting a little Michael Jackson, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Tony Stark, but I think I may need you to beat it. Moonwalk your ass on out of here. You crazy person.
Shouldn't start this conversation with a settlement offer. It was a funny uncomfortable, because just the silliness of the scene of And not only and Aunt May should not have let that happen.
No, she was strangely comfortable with Tony Stark taking little Peter off to his bedroom. That sounded dirty.
Take my 15-year-old nephew off to a room eccentric millionaire who just showed up at our house.
Nothing creepy about that.
Says you learned about him online.
But credit to the folks over at the MCU, to Kevin Feige and anybody who was involved in the casting of Spider-Man, because Tom Holland really knocked it out of the park. And having the gumption, if you will, to actually go to a 15-year-old Peter Parker rather than having him be like college age, like the last several Spider-Man films have gone, I thought that in itself was just a very smart move, and to see how well they choreographed him into the scenes, even though he, let's just be honest, because I think that it will help all of us if we can just go ahead and say that Spider-Man was kind of shoehorned into all this. They put him in there because they could, because they finally got that deal worked out. I geeked out too, because Spider-Man was the first superhero I ever loved, but yeah, he could have been left out of that movie and you still get to the same place. But it was really, really freaking cool to see him, and Tom Holland knocked that out of the park. It actually made me excited for the Solo movie that's coming up. So that's my take.
Yeah, I thought they handled that well, and I like that it's different type of character. They got a lot of 30 to 35-year-old white dudes. I think it's a good idea to start spreading that around. It wouldn't hurt them to maybe someday think about doing a female lead. But I like that there's
I've been waiting on that Black Widow movie for years.
My only thought now is that she just doesn't want to do it. Like I can't imagine that it's.
Well, Kevin Feige commented recently that they're very committed to making it happen. And of course my response was, I'll believe that when I see it, sir. Let me see that on your Phase 4 schedule.
They're 0 for, what, 18 now?
Yeah. So they have yet to pull the trigger on that one. I mean, do we count Ant-Man and Wasp? I don't know if I count that, because it's co-leads.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe half.
Captain Marvel coming up, though.
And we'll see. It's been pushed back twice, though.
Yeah, that's true. Like they say that, well, I mean, Carol Danvers is supposed to show up in one of these probably the very next Avengers movie, which definitely needs to happen, because I'm a Carol Danvers fan. I want to see her. I want to see that happen. And I'm like, yes, like you don't have to make her Ms. Marvel. You can totally skip that. Just go straight into her being Captain Marvel. I want to see that happen. Because I feel like the MCU needs it. I mean, we've had Black Widow and we got Scarlet Witch, and I like both of their characters. I thought they were done really well. And Scarlet Witch and Vision were actually really well nuanced in Civil War. I was more intrigued by them than I ever expected to be. But there does need to be more of a stronger female presence in these movies, and it's something that we haven't had. Black Widow is there, and she gets these like really great moments, but you can't help but feel like she's still being underwritten in a way. I mean, that's not just me, right?
Yeah, she's not given a lot to do. Marvel movies are unfortunately not known for giving any female character vital tasks. It's one of the things I don't like about Thor 2 is that Natalie Portman could have been Natalie Portman could have been replaced by a cat, and it would not have changed anything that happened in that movie. if you told Thor the ether has infected your cat. You got to take your cat back to Asgard so that we can save it. And he's like, "Oh my god, my cat!" It would have been exactly the same film.
And the thing is,
she does nothing in that movie.
And I will say that the cat probably would have acted it more convincingly.
if ever there was an actor that had no interest in being where they were.
In either Thor movie and any of the Star Wars prequels, Natalie Portman is the most bored person on film.
Never seems to be happy where she is.
She doesn't care about these movies. She's phoning it in. She's collecting a paycheck. It's like her agent is clearly old Hollywood, because he's like, do the safe picture, the big, like, big budget picture so that we can make a whole bunch of money. Then you can go do your little Black Swan art house stuff and then really give that Oscar-winning performance.
So it's one of the things I really liked about Winter Soldier. Winter Soldier is my favorite out of the Marvel movies.
Seconded.
And it's because and you know, one of the many reasons I like that movie is that Black Widow has something constructive to do.
Very much so.
You know, she actually does things that forward the plot, which is quite a change from what the Iron Man movies were like for her.
And she had more chemistry with Chris Evans than the lady that plays Sharon Carter. No disrespect to her because I like her, but when I saw the chemistry that was going on between Black Widow and Cap, and I was like, you know, there's something to this. And then it didn't happen, and they paired her off with Hulk because that makes sense.
I think thematically it makes sense, but I mean, only if you ever put the two of them in a movie.
Oh, they're just lucky that she and Mark Ruffalo actually did have really great chemistry together. Otherwise, I'd have been like, "What is this?"
I think thematically it makes sense because they're both hiding a monster. Is that deep enough for you?
No, that makes sense. I mean, especially all the stuff. I mean, that's the one thing that Age of Ultron really does very well is give us that intriguing backstory, the Red Room and all that stuff that happened to Black Widow. And I'm like, when I saw that, I was like, there's the solo movie setup. There it is right there. Yeah. Give me that right now.
Yeah.
It's perfect. You just gave us a backdoor way of having this movie happen. And it still hasn't. Feige.
Yeah, and I mean, they
failed this fandom.
They built some stuff out in Agent Carter with, you know, the Black Widow of that era. So, you know, establish this as a mantle that's carried. There's lots there. I don't know what's holding them back. I mean, at this point, they're not going to announce anything until they see how Wonder Woman does.
And that's true. I think that they're going to, like, hedge their bets a little bit to see how that turns out. But good on Warner Brothers for giving Wonder Woman, you know, more than 100. I think it's probably going to be like $150 million to $175 million production budget for Wonder Woman. That should be plenty to make it a pretty solid picture. And
it's one of the biggest budgets for a female lead movie, and it is the biggest budget ever given to a female director.
Which is, that's great for Warner Brothers. That's good press. And they need it. This gives us a great segue. I'm going to ride in on two wheels all the way. I don't need a helmet. Because we're going to crash right through this wall and start talking DC films. Because, you know, that thing about Wonder Woman, that has got to be my most anticipated movie for next year. Even above Justice League, even though I'm very much looking forward to that movie. Wonder Woman is a bit above it for me because Gal Gadot really won me over in Batman v Superman. Like, I wasn't totally sure on her going in, but when I saw her on screen, I was like, she nailed it. Got it. Can't wait to see this solo movie. Give me that right now. And her theme music was almost a take on the Justice League Unlimited theme, and I was nerding so hard in the theater. Like, all four times that I saw it. But the there's been a bit of a shakeup.
Before we get into that part, I'll just say, like, Gal Gadot has incredible screen presence. It feels like she's in so much of that movie, and she's got like eight lines or something. Like, she's in barely any of it. She's got a couple of wordless scenes that she carries completely. She does so much with just looks. In the scene in Batman Superman at the party, she conveys so much with just looks and glances. Stellar casting, amazing casting. To take this person that had in America had only been in the Fast and the Furious movies, and say that's the person that can play Wonder Woman. You know, no one bought it. No one thought that she. It was the strangest casting. Like, you know, to cast a basically unknown. She just steals every scene she's in.
That was exactly the reaction. I remember that reaction very well. Like, lot of skinny body shaming going on and everything. And
yeah.
And then when you see the performance, it's like, well, all those thoughts are gone.
Which was just, I mean, as well as just being douchebag stuff to start with, so much of that was kept going back to, why didn't you cast Jamie Alexander, who's got exactly the same build and is exactly the same height?
And then they also compared her to Linda Carter, who played Wonder Woman on the 70s TV show.
Yeah.
But then you see side-by-side pictures of Linda Carter back in the 70s when she was playing Wonder Woman. She's the same size as Gal Gadot is now.
Yeah.
It's like they're both skinny. So let's not even make that comparison like it's a thing. That's just people bitching.
What they really wanted to say was she's got small boobs.
Mm-hmm. That's what it is.
And if that's your opinion, then just say that, but don't pretend it's anything. Don't pretend it's about her relative height to Bruce Wayne. Just, you know, frick right off. That's not what you mean.
Yeah, it's a load of crap that they're like trying to hide what they're actually saying. It's like, look, Gina Carano was my original top choice to play Wonder Woman. I'll admit that. But I don't think that she wouldn't have done as good a job as what Gal Gadot did. That is absolutely cemented in my mind now. There's no way that she would have been the absolute right choice for that character. And she certainly couldn't have like carried a superhero movie to that level. So I was wrong on that, and I was very happy to be proven wrong by a stellar performance from a very talented young lady who I think is going to blow a lot of people's minds when it comes to her solo film. But speaking of all that, like we got Suicide Squad coming up first, though.
Mm-hmm.
That's another one that had a little bit of controversy around it. Probably still does, but I think those trailers are winning a lot of people over.
I think so. I mean, certainly the reaction to Joker was huge.
Mm-hmm.
When that first image came out with him all tattooed up, there was a lot of crazy reaction to that. Because it is so different. The people who are stuck in the animated version of Harley Quinn have had a problem with it. But this, really, that character's been reinvented so many times that I was a little surprised there was any of that left. Like, I didn't think anyone could still be unhappy with a new take, because it's not that much. Like, her aesthetic is the same as it was in the Arkham games.
In a lot of ways, yeah, it very much looks like that.
And it's what we've been seeing in the comics for 5 years. It's what you see at Hot Topic. But I mean, there's always those fans that are locked into a very particular view. It's been funny seeing Bruce Timm talk about it, because he's super excited.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, you should only do it Bruce Timm's way. Meanwhile, Bruce Timm is like, I cannot wait to see this movie.
Paul Dini's right there with him.
Yeah.
They're both like, you know what? We're getting to see our character that we created as a one-off throwaway character suddenly as a starring role in a major motion picture, and we're getting paid, son.
And this character is like, I've seen from the very first trailers, this character's going to steal this movie.
Oh, absolutely.
I was in a Hot Topic the other day, and I looked at the little bit of Harley Quinn section, and I'm like, y'all don't know what this is going to be like come Christmas. You are not ready for how Harley Quinn is going to just take over.
I don't think you have to wait that long. I think by Halloween it's going to be like the Harley Quinn show.
It's already taken over the cosplay. Like from the first photos that came out, that costume has just skyrocketed to the top. Like the last convention I was at, it was Harley Quinn and Rey.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Because both of those characters are just hugely popular, and yeah. I'm thinking that I think there's going to be a few more surprises coming out of Suicide Squad, though. I think we're going to get maybe finally a real breakout performance from Jai Courtney as Captain Boomerang. I think more people are going to be excited to see him in a movie. I'll certainly finally be like saying, "Hey, Jai Courtney," instead of "Jai Courtney." I felt that way since Terminator Salvation. Not Terminator Salvation. It was, or yeah, he wasn't in that. He was in Genesis. He was in the new Terminator movie, but he was in some other stuff before that. That I was.
He
also,
was in.
I also hated.
He did one of like the swashbuckler type movies, right? He did like Clash of the Titans or something like that, right?
I think that was him.
Was it that one, or it was something like that?
I mostly
Immortals, or there was kind of a
that was actually Henry Cavill.
There was a slew of them came out at one time that were, they're all kind of like gods and monsters kind of stuff.
And I actually kind of dug Immortals a little bit because Henry Cavill really gives a good performance in that. But man, Mickey Rourke is so unbelievable in the villain role. Cause
oh yeah,
I was like,
it's been a while in that one.
It's a pretty like. Honestly, when Mickey Rourke is on screen, it's pretty terrible because it just doesn't work. But like, I totally bought Henry Cavill as Theseus. I was like, you know what? He can totally pull this off, and he's doing it pretty well in a movie that looks like it was ripped straight out of the pages of 300. Zack Snyder should be so happy that everybody keeps ripping him off. And they have since 300. I mean, you can't say that his influence is not felt everywhere. But speaking of him, I think a mountain is being made of a molehill when it comes to the Warner executive reaction to the negative critical reaction to Batman v Superman, in that they're supposedly butting heads with Zack Snyder. Because the guy is still directing Justice League, and it is filming right now.
It's so hard to know what's rumor and what's fact.
It really
is. I mean, we were both quite unhappy with the way that the media presented the release and the reaction to Batman Superman. And the biggest piece that frustrated me was people who were against the movie to start said it had to make $1 billion to be successful. And then it didn't make $1 billion. And they said, CWB must be unhappy because it didn't make $1 billion. But no one at Warner Brothers ever for a moment said it has to make this much money. Like, that was all invented by people who didn't want the movie to happen to begin with. So we don't know what their mark of success was. We don't know anything about the finances of this movie. We don't know what break even was. All of these are invented numbers by people who, had an axe to grind against this film from the beginning.
And I mean, I don't want to say that it's an anti-DC or even an anti-Warner Brothers thing going on, but I do think there's an anti-Zack Snyder sentiment that runs in a lot of critic circles and has for like several years now. So anything the guy does, they're automatically that predisposed to hate. But as far as like the measure of metric success goes, I would say that on a production budget of $250 million, which is less than what it cost to make Superman Returns, by the way, which was... Mm-hmm. That didn't even make I think it made like around $400 million worldwide.
Yeah.
You're not going to tell me, and I don't think you can really convince anybody that off of that, even if you tack on another $100 million for marketing and whatever else, that $871 million take worldwide is in any way a failure.
They
wanted it to be more. They would have wanted that.
Of course they wanted it to be more.
But that's not a failure.
But, I mean, when Man of Steel came out and it did whatever it did in the box office...
668.
Yeah. There were all these articles about how it was a huge disaster.
Overblown.
And then Warner Brothers' reaction to this huge disaster was to put $250 million into Batman Superman and $500 million sight unseen into three more movies.
And... Yeah, that doesn't make sense, does it? Like when you start.
Clearly their mark of success and what others think is the mark of success are very different. It'll tap out somewhere just below $900 million gross, which means take home, call it $450 million. It's not going to, you know, it's. They're not going to be buying a new state or anything. With the proceeds of it, but what was the point box office, or was the point to have something they can sell for the rest of time, the way that they will Man of Steel. Like, you're going to see Man of Steel on Netflix, in the DVD bins, on every new Warner app for the rest of our lives, because they own that. So was the point to make $100 million? Was the point to make $1 billion box office, or was the point to have a product with Batman and Superman's names on it?
And that's it's a good way to look at it, because you know that these are properties that, yeah, they're going to keep going back to this well. They're going to keep coming back to it, just like Disney. They own Marvel. They're going to keep going back to that well, even when those actors age out and they eventually have to close out the universe. They might let it cool off for a little while, but you're dreaming if you think that they won't reboot it. They'll totally do that. And like Warner Brothers is practiced in the art of the reboot. So,
well, and I've been saying for a while that like since we did a podcast on We Talk Comics. Right after Batman Superman came out, and we had Brett Booth, who, I tell you, you said that you would give way to me as a bigger Man of Steel fan. I will give way to Brett Booth. Man of Steel is my favorite comic movie. Man of Steel is Brett's favorite movie, period.
I listened to that podcast, and he was on some Man of Steel, yo.
Oh, man.
And I'll be perfectly honest, Brett, this is an open invitation. Anytime you want to come on the show, bro, you hit me up on Twitter. Come on the show. Please, please come on the show. We will talk. It will be the Man of Steel verbal filleting hour. I have no qualms with doing that. But I'll be perfectly honest, and this is just for full disclosure, I'm not a huge fan of his art. It's just sometimes I'm not a big fan of his art. His stuff on Flash really didn't work for me most of the time. Although I really, some of his stuff on Teen Titans I dug, and, honestly, I'm buying Titans as soon as that comes out because, I see the passion that he has for that and, working with Dan Abnett, and I'm like, hey, let's do this thing. I'm ready.
And see, I don't like Dan Abnett. So,
oh, well, there you go. I was about to sing the praises of Dan Abnett's Aquaman too, because it's back to Jeff Johns levels, y'all. Y'all got to go out and get that.
Since I did that, I had the thought while we were talking about it there, and it's stuck with me, is that I don't think DC is intending to make an open-ended universe.
No.
I don't think that DC Warner Brothers is making a we're going to keep building forever universe the way that Marvel has. I think this may be something like a 10 movie cycle, and then they'll do Crisis.
And that would be ballsy.
I think they could very well. I mean, they could do it story wise, or they could just restart the way they did with Batman. I mean, Batman has had 3 cold starts in our lifetime. Like in films, that's as many as Punisher. As Punisher or Spider-Man.
That's as many as 4 tens, and that's terrible. There's you a reference. If you catch that, you are truly a Superman nerd.
James Bond's only had 2. I don't think it's meant to be an open-ended universe, and I think that explains a lot of the choices they've made. But it's exciting that it's not. Like I'm excited by the idea that this could be one long story, and then they start again with a fresh story. I think the Marvel universe is already getting bogged down. They're already getting stuck, and the decision to tie TV shows into the movies, I think, has particularly S.H.I.E.L.D. has hindered them more than helped.
It has, and the thing is, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. doesn't even really feel like it ties into the movies anymore. Like, they mention stuff every once in a while, but it's totally the embarrassing child that they've told to go play in the corner or something so that we don't have to acknowledge you.
It's left over now, yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing with that, and it's the same with like the Netflix shows, but which are a completely different quality. They are all very good, but the movies are never going to acknowledge them. They acknowledge the movies, not the other way around.
Yeah, and I kind of like leaving it be. Like, I I kind of like the idea that the Netflix shows will just be their thing. And yeah, they mention every once in a while that they're in the same universe. But I mean, that's kind of the old Marvel way in the comics, is that you didn't necessarily have to acknowledge that Galactus invaded, but you might say traffic sure is backed up. I wonder what's going on. And then there's the editor's note of, you know, see Fantastic Four to find out what is going on.
And what a crazy thing to try and like a TV to film idea, which is, I mean, it is neat to have everybody feel like these movies and TV shows all take place in the same universe. But honestly, you could remove that part and you still get the same shows and same films. Yeah. It's all still there, running the exact same race that it was running before. And I know some people are kind of mad about, you know, Grant Gustin not being the Flash in the DCEU, or at least in the film side. But I actually agree with Zack Snyder's assessment that, you know, he is one type of Flash. He's like, he's playing a version of that character that works very well in that universe. But he wouldn't fit with what they're doing in the film side. So it wouldn't make a lot of sense to do that. And you'd be saddled with something else too, because you wouldn't be able to just take Grant and move him over. You would have to take the entire cast of The Flash and move them too. So it's a package deal.
That whole idea is so like the tail wagging the dog. Like, mm-hmm. The reality is that people say, hey, you know, the critics say that Batman versus Superman underperformed at just shy $900 million. That means it sold over 100 million tickets. Flash, at its best, has 4 million viewers. So how do you make the TV shows the lead role in this pyramid?
I think it's a measure of like what has the goodwill, or at least as far as the internet chatter goes. Because I mean,
yeah, that's purely internet based. Like it has nothing to do with the reality of you need to. If $1 billion is now what his success is, it's a strange world we live in that you have to be in the top 25 performing movies of all time to be a successful movie.
And you would have to be one of only 6 comic book movies to have reached $1 billion.
I believe the average now that that Box Office Mojo lists is $8.50 or $8.70 or something like that.
Yeah.
So you're at 120 million tickets sold. How do you scale that up? From goodwill and 4 million people that watch the TV show.
And it is a hard metric to make. But the thing is, and I've said this to several people about the DC universe, I mean, if you're a DC fan, you've been used to the idea of a multiverse for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You should have been. And the Flash TV show has done a really good job explaining what a multiverse is. So if you've been watching that and then you go see the movies, you should automatically go into that mindset of, oh, it's another Earth. It is another dimension on the way. It might not necessarily be my favorite dimension or whatever, but it exists. There it is. That's fine.
Yeah.
It can be what it's going to be while not interfering with this other thing that I love. And
I had someone a couple of weeks ago start the complaining about the movies and the TVs TV shows not tying together. And they had already told me that they hated Man of Steel. And I said, so do you want Supergirl to need to tie into Man of Steel? And the little blood started pouring down from the side of the corner of their eye.
It's coming out of their ears and nose.
That's exactly it. Like, you hated Man of Steel. Like, that person hated Man of Steel. They wouldn't want Supergirl and Man of Steel to have to fit together. I loved Man of Steel. I also don't want them to tie together. So what's the problem?
And on that note, I'm going to piss off all the hardcore Supergirl fans and Man of Steel haters out there and let you know and let you think about this for a minute. Supergirl's first season has the same plot that Man of Steel did. And it recreated one of the most controversial scenes from Man of Steel when Mr. Danvers, Dr. Danvers, tells Kara that she probably should have let the people in that car die.
Yeah, I know that. That one hit for me. Yeah, I think most people missed that one.
They did. They walked right by it, and I was like, yeah. That's the same scene.
Yeah.
Like, that is Man of Steel recreated all over again,
yeah.
And yet it gets a pass because it's all bright and chipper. But
I always have a laugh when people talk about Flash as being bright and chipper and positive and optimistic. I'm like, you know, you spent the entire first season watching his mom die every third episode, right?
Yeah, there's some darkness in Flash.
He smiled.
Is that he smiled and told jokes, and Cisco makes you laugh because that's what it takes. And I'll be honest, I didn't like Cisco to begin with. I thought he was overly silly and trying way too hard to make us like him. But he grew on me. I'll give the guy a lot of credit. Like I'm kind of a vibe fan now. Going into especially in the second season, I felt like he's carried a lot of emotional weight on his shoulders. And always been a big Tom Cavanaugh fan, so I was very happy to see him in anything. And Grant Gustin is a revelation. So there, I've verbally filleted the Flash as much.
Grant,
as,
that the show is not seen as dark because Grant Gustin is so good. I stand by that show would be really it would be Arrow serious if Grant Gustin wasn't so good in the role.
And even Arrow has become more comic booky, I guess it would be the terminology I'd use now. Because I've been going back and doing like a series rewatch of it. Mm-hmm. From season one to now, it's a night and day difference.
Yeah, huge difference, yeah.
Totally different show by now. But I love that, though. I love that they can evolve over time like that and like change up who they are and what they are.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that Flash can do that, too. I don't want it to get stale to people. I don't want it to be like it was a big hit in its first couple of seasons, but then everybody's like, you're just doing the same thing over and over again. You don't seem to evolve. But, and speaking of that, our last subject before we close out, that Flash season finale.
That was craziness.
Did you see the guy in the Iron Mask coming?
I did, actually. Not for long, but I did predict that and I sent it to a friend, so I have proof that I did.
He's like, I'm not making it up.
I'm not. I didn't for a long time. I did suspect for quite a while that it was the real Jay Garrick. Because there were a few different things, but one of them was like it just didn't make sense to me. Like once we knew the origin of Zoom, I'm like, well, Jay Garrick's not just a fake name, so that's probably the real Jay Garrick. Expecting that it would be the same actor still. And then it locked for me, maybe it was the third to last episode, when there's just a throwaway line where Henry Allen says, Garrick, that was my mom's maiden name.
That was a great moment.
When he said that, I'm like, that's who's behind the mask. Now I get it. Now I get where they're going.
And yeah, when they took that mask off and it was him, I was like, I had that same moment you did. I was just like, I knew it. I knew it was him under there. And I loved the costume that they gave him too, or the suit that he had at the end and showing him use speed powers. And I was like,
I'm hoping he shows up on Legends of Tomorrow, actually.
That would be really cool, especially since, you know, Our Man was introduced in the season finale of that. And they mentioned Justice Society. And I'm like, here we go. I'm like, all those people have been wanting a Justice Society in the movies. He's like, no, we're getting it on TV, and they're slowly building this up right now. And I'm like shaking because this is happening.
You know, folks got to get over the whole it should be like the movie is the better thing. The movie was Batman versus Superman was 2.5 hours long, and it took us 3 years to get it. I got 18 hours of Flash this year. So screw the movie. Give me a Justice Society TV show.
Yeah.
Give me 10 episodes. What's that, 450, 440 minutes of Justice Society? Give me that.
Yeah, and how
I'll
about
take that over a movie.
And they did something even crazier at the end. I mean, we talked about the Jay Garrick reveal, but that wasn't the biggest point for me.
No.
The biggest point was Barry went back in time and actually saved his mom. They recreated the flashpoint start at least the starting point of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, what have you done, Barry? Like, what is about to happen here?
What a crazy place to leave it.
I know. I mean, that was a, like, sickeningly great cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy that they were already renewed for a season three, because if they had been renewed for season three and then left us right there, I'd have been like, you sons of bitches. That would have been the worst ending cliffhanger of all time. That would have made me more upset than Flash Forward did. There's your reference.
Stupid no ending Flash Forward.
I know. Or Surface. There's another one.
One of my pet peeves is there are shows that I got behind, and then I would just ask people, is there an ending to this? And if it's no, that's it. I've never watched the last 10 episodes of Terminator because I know there's not an ending to it.
And I think that's another I also stopped watching Revolution because it just got really bad.
Well, you should stop watching it if it's bad. I'll give you that.
I think I got like 4 or 5 episodes in the season two, and I was just like, I'm out. This sucks. It became unwatchable. But enough about bad TV shows. We're back on Flash. Like, that's so
I a bold move and a crazy direction to go, and a great opportunity to bring in anyone they want. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about going this direction is when they got to the end of this season, I'm like, what do you do with Tom Cavanaugh now? Because they found a way, even though they killed him in the first season, they found a way to include him in the second season. So how do you include him in the third season now?
I'm thinking that since Barry went back and saved his mom, he stops Reverse Flash. He stops him from ever taking over Tom Cavanaugh's or the Harrison Wells body.
Yeah.
So we get legit Harrison Wells in season
Earth
3.
We're back to Earth 1 Harrison Wells, yeah.
Yeah, it's like he's never been possessed or whatever by Reverse Flash. And I think that also says that, you know, Barry may have created a paradox there that he never becomes the Flash. Do the full Flashpoint thing.
I think that's probably where we'll start, yeah.
Without, you know, the whole Aquaman and Wonder Woman flooding the world.
It's funny you mention that because when they do that moment and I'm like, oh my god, Flashpoint paradox. It's Flashpoint, but they can't do Aquaman and Wonder Woman.
Nope. Also can't do. But could you do the Thomas Wayne Batman?
Oh, I wonder. I wonder if they could. Yeah, I wonder if they would.
I was like, you might. I would say that that's a gray area. That's one of those, it's like, I wouldn't say definitely no. I would lean towards no, they couldn't, because it would be Batman. And there still seems to be an unspoken rule that you can't use Batman characters in the Flareverse. Mm-hmm. But if there is ever an opportunity to bring a Batman into this show, it could be the Thomas Wayne version. And if you did Flashpoint, that makes the most sense.
I mean, they've done so much with Arrow picking up Batman stuff that I wonder if they'll use someone from that universe. That someone else becomes Arrow or something like that.
Which, hey, that might work.
That maybe they bring back Arrow's dad to be Arrow or something. Like, I think they could. I think they could use the same concept and play it up differently.
And that's assuming that Flash's season finale actually affects Arrow.
I imagine it won't in the sense that Arrow will just kind of go on and doing its own thing. But I think because it's not like they're going to play the whole season doing Flashpoint.
Oh, no, you couldn't do that. That would wear thin very quickly.
So I think we've probably got a short arc. And then because we also know there's going to be a line-wide crossover between the four shows sometime this year and next year as well.
Yeah. It's in December of this year. And this is probably how they bring Supergirl into their universe and no longer have her being on like her own Earth.
Could be, yeah.
And that's something they're going to have to do. I mean, moving her over to CW, that's great. That puts her closer to home base for Greg Berlanti anyway. Mm-hmm. But you've got to take that plunge. You've got to do that crisis event that brings Supergirl into the fold in a more natural way. And
yeah, it's going to be clunky to have her come over every episode. Like every time you want to do a crossover, she has to go through the 52 gateway and that kind of thing. It'd be a little clunky.
Yeah, that would not work. So they're absolutely going to have to do, you know, a full crisis event. And I think it works. I think that you do that, instead of calling it crisis, they'll call it Flashpoint, because there does seem to be a little, I don't know, a little aversion to saying the word crisis at DC these days. Ever since Final Crisis happened, they're like, nope, that's it. Committed to that idea of being, that's the last one, damn it. Never again. I'm okay with it. But if they go the Flashpoint route, which is what's hinted at strongly, that's a way of folding in one Earth into this other one. Could work. Mm-hmm. Could work. Yeah. I got to tell you, like, Grant Gustin and Melissa Benoist have just this amazing chemistry together.
Oh, absolutely.
We got to see more of that. And, you know, at the time of this recording, the Arrow season finale has not aired yet, but I can guarantee you that I was glued to my television the day after to watch it on Hulu, who is not a sponsor of this show, but if they'd like to be, open invitation. We'll totally advertise your stuff, you know, for a small fee. But anyway, you know, we've talked, we got some Legends of Tomorrow stuff worked in there too. Like, I'm very happy that we were able to talk about that a little bit, because I've loved that show this season as well. I thought it had a really strong first season.
They really stuck the landing. Those last four episodes that worked as just one long story, really just nailed the show. Like, I loved what they were doing.
And how good of a villain was Vandal Savage at the end? Like,
they really went a cool direction with the run. And I'm interested because, I mean, they built the whole first season out of seeding characters from Flash and Arrow. So I'm now curious if they're going to do the same. Like, so if we're going to get Jay Garrick move over to that next year, if they've done the same kind of seeding from one to the other plan that they, you know, did for first to season one.
I'm totally in for some more Jay Garrick. Love that. I mean, we only got a little bit of him there at the end of Flash, but it was a good bit. It was a very good bit. And I'm excited to see what they're doing with all of these characters, actually. And I'm wondering, and man, the possibilities are really endless. Mm-hmm. They can go so many directions here. And you know, a show like this, I like to hold up Flash and Legends of Tomorrow as clear examples of Geoff Johns actually being a very good executive whenever people listen to him. Like, when he's actually put in charge of something, he can make it work and make it work well. But you have to actually let him have some authority, because if he doesn't, then it's all for naught. And that's what I'm hoping for out of his new role over at DC Films, actually, is that he and John Byrd can get together and really make something great happen. I hate that takes him away from the comic book side of things, but if he's being given a position of authority, then I think we're in for something really cool. I don't know how long it'll take to actually get to seeing his actual work, but I don't know. I feel hopeful. I feel very optimistic about the future of all of this. As somebody who was not disappointed, really, by Batman v Superman like some people were. But I think we got a bright future ahead of us.
I think I'm a big fan of Geoff Johns. I love what particularly Flash. I think I've had some downer moments because of the way it's been framed in the media. You know, his move over to DC Films has really been framed as a throw the baby out with the bathwater for what they've done so far. And I don't know that that's, I don't think it's true, because I mean, Zack Snyder's currently making Justice League. So, they could be like, we don't know what impact this is going to have on Justice League specifically. Suicide Squad's already done. Wonder Woman's filmed. So, I mean, it could be into 2018 before we really see the impact of Jeff Johns.
Yeah, and I think you're right there that some people throwing that out there like, oh, it's they're just basically starting from scratch all over again. It's like, nah, I don't think it's a good idea to assume that because Jeff Johns doesn't seem like the type of guy to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, look at his comics work. He never did that. Like, he changed the bathwater out, but he never threw the baby out with it.
And it also assumes that Johns hasn't had that much of a role so far, which I don't think is true either.
Yeah, that's also true. Like, he's had – I think he had more role now than he did, say, with the Green Lantern movie, where it seemed like they took a bunch of his ideas – and he was like, yeah, run with that. And then they were like, well, let's just cobble them all together and make a turd of a movie. And he was like, that's not what I told you to do with my ideas. I was like, I appreciate you using my ideas, but come on. And I'm really hoping, you know, that if there's one movie out there that I want him to have the most, like, creative say over, it would be Green Lantern Corps.
Yeah.
Like, that's the movie, like, if no others, if he doesn't have much creative say on any of them, I want him to be that guy who's basically sitting right there behind the director saying, yep, do this, don't do that, do this, this is the story point, what are you doing, stop, go. You know, basically he's the power behind the throne. That's what I want to see. Like, if he does that, cool, we're all good. And, you know, kind of on that note, I think we've kind of come to the end of the show. We've been at this for quite a while now. I know I keep saying I'm going to make these podcasts shorter, but it's just never going to happen. So, you know, strap in for 2 hours of this every time you come back. I'm totally kidding. We never know how long these shows are going to go. But, Keith, I want to say thanks for taking some time out with me and being on the show. You know, it's fun to finally talk with you, like, in this setting rather than, like, through 140 characters on Twitter. This has been a lot of fun for me. I hope you've had a good time.
Absolutely.
And don't forget, guys, that you can check out all of Keith's ranting and ravings over at comicosity.com on the We Talk Comics podcast. And, you know, if you guys are a big Man of Steel fan and Batman v Superman fan, you're definitely going to want to check out his stuff. The guy knows what he's talking about. And follow him on Twitter while you're at it. He's pretty easy to find, you know, if you're following me anyway. You keep changing, well, your Twitter handle's a little odd. Like, tell the people what that is.
I'm at Cub Reporter K is my handle. My name is all in code.
That, which is weird.
It's inspired by the fabulous comic book Dave. I changed it 2 years ago and just never got around to changing it back.
I've still not read that book, but on your recommendation, I'm probably going to be checking that out.
So, such a great book, such a hilarious book. It is about the robot. It is about after the robot apocalypse and how much robots just become like us after they don't have humans to kill.
That sounds like something I'm going to need to read, and I think all listeners out there, you guys need to go check out. Make sure you check out Dave. Go to comicosity.com, and of course you can always find this podcast and all of our wonderful placetobenation.com podcast at placetobenation.com. It's a Place to Be Network podcast. We got plenty of other really great ones out there for you to listen to if you're a comic book fan. My guy Todd Weber's got a great podcast when Weber Has Issues. And, of course, the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Nick and Greg, every week, because those guys work way harder than I do to make this happen and to make you guys some good content. So make sure you check them out. And, Keith, thanks again, man, for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, and I hope you'll come back and visit us again soon.
Great fun.
All right, guys, that's it. We're out of here. We'll see you next time. Sellers Points Podcast, where... who knows what kind of business we're going to get into, but if you've stuck with me this long, hey, why not come back, right? Come and check out the show. It's fun. We'll see you then.